Hello and welcome to the show. My name's Ed Mann, and today we're very lucky to be joined by Vlad Kononov for part two of Learning Domain-Driven Design. If you've missed part one, be sure to check that out, as that's where we covered the foundations. But if you've already listened to part one, let's dive in. And then moving on from there, I've got a little bit of a thought experiment. It's definitely not the way I would say we should probably do things, but I'm just trying to test out the boundaries of a bounded context, like the ideology behind it, or the meaning behind it. And so I'm thinking, like, could a bounded context be implemented in several different languages, services, and functions, where the models and business rules are replicated in implementation? So an example here is that, say, if we have an authoritative write model, like with invariants in one language, and then we actually build projections and read models in other languages to consume those events. And, you know, are these projections still part of the same bounded context? They're following the same language, the meaning behind them. It doesn't corrupt any of, you know, there's no different meaning there. Do they form separate bounded contexts? Obviously, this, yeah, different languages is a bit strange, but it's just trying to work out those boundaries. Like, would we still class this as one bounded context, even though we're essentially duplicating the model in multiple different languages?
Yeah, so I guess you're talking about the Securus pattern, which is kind of, hey, the elephant in the room. Because the two guys that formulated this pattern, Greg Young and Udi Dehan, they always keep saying that, hey, Securus is not for high-level architecture stuff. It's the way you design the logic within a bounded context. Both of them keep saying that. Guess what people keep doing? Now, the problem is, okay, let's follow what they're saying. Let's use that within one bounded context. Now, that CQRS pattern produces projections of the same model, and those projections are different models. So we kind of going against the idea of domain-driven design. Suddenly we have multiple models within the same bounded context. Now, it is still okay. It is still fine because let me use a different example from domain-driven design. The same anti-corruption layer that I just mentioned, it uses multiple models. It just uses one as input, the second one as output. One as source of truth, the second one is projection. So that CQRS pattern just uses the same idea, but for a different set of data. Data that is not coming from outside, but rather from inside out. Just a different direction of the data flow, of the model flow.
That's really interesting. And so, yeah, so kind of going into that more then, it's like, and this is a very ugly system, but we imagine we share a database, we share the model, but I have one, you know, two services that interact to build this functionality up, this bounded context functionality. And they're in different languages, but they also replicate, for some horrible reason, they replicate the behavior as well. So they're bound by the model invariants, they're bound by the ubiquitous language and the kind of behaviors that they have. Could you still class that as one bounded context? Or would that be really pulling on it? I mean, why would you ever do this? This is more, again, a thought experiment in this kind of thing.
Well, let me try to pull that thought experiment into a bit different direction, but let's see if that makes sense. Let's say that you have a business rule, something that you want to enforce in your system in the most efficient way possible. Let's say, using the same business domain of advertising campaigns, you have a business rule that says that a campaign that has fewer than $10 on its budget cannot be published. You can implement that business rule in the backend, of course. But come on, we want our system to perform, right? We don't want to make them wait for the backend to process that. We want to make that on client side. Why even make that button enabled? So we have to implement the same business rule. We have to replicate that knowledge from the backend to the frontend. Now, duplicating knowledge is a recipe for disaster. Now, going back to the idea of bounded context, if we have multiple deployable units, in this case, we have frontend and backend, if we follow that rule that all of them are going to be deployed simultaneously, then we are protecting ourselves from changing it in one place and then forgetting about the other. Well, at least if that happens, we'll know about it immediately. So that can happen. You can observe cases where the same business rule is implemented in different programming languages. Now, if you're talking about ubiquitous languages, like models of the business domain, then I would say no. Only one of them is the source of truth in a bounded context. That's it.
So, and the others then in this kind of case, where we're, so it would be the single bounded context that has both the front end and back end, but the back end is the source of truth to this, the model. And it just so happens that we're also putting it in on the front end implementation.
Yeah, so that example is about that validation logic. If we're talking about multiple models in the backend and those multiple models modify the same set of data, I would say no. That goes against the idea of DDD.
That's good. And then also you could add a good measure, maybe putting procedural things inside of the database and stuff, and add three levels of places where you can distill all of these invariants.
Yeah. 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 I'll tell you an anecdote from my experience. I once encountered a custom version of a database, an open source database that was compiled with business rules inside of it in order for it to perform better.
Wow. I mean, yeah, if that's going to, you know, be your market and, you know, your value adds, I can't see how or why. But yeah, different. I wonder if this business is still going in my head. That's the question, isn't it?
No, that's
definitely, there you go. Oh dear. And so kind of moving on with these thought experiments a little bit, and I do apologize for the amount of thought experiments here. Let's take like a communication so as an idea. So we have this communication as a supporting subdomain of, say, this a business. And inside it, we might have a templating bounded context, orchestration for when and how we send emails or these kind of communications, compliance for consent, GDPR and all that fun stuff. And then channel delivery bounded context, like email, SMS, and push. But if those channel delivery bounded contexts are really just thin wrappers around vendors like SendGrid or SNS, would we actually consider these as a separate subdomain, basically treating the vendor integration as generic, while the orchestration, the compliance, and templating remain supporting? In other words, is it useful to distinguish between the communications as a supporting subdomain and then the channel delivery as a generic subdomain? Or do we have one supporting subdomain that the subdomain is possibly too coarse? I've realized I've said subdomain a lot in that wording.
Well, there are two ways I can answer your question. The first one is the short one. It's two words. It depends. And the second one is a bit more words. So look, let's say you have a bounded context. It can encompass multiple generic solutions, generic subdomains. That's fine. Again, the limitation is whatever deployable artifacts you have there within that wider bounded context, all of them have to be redeployed simultaneously. You have that limitation of the knowledge of that ownership boundary. Who are the people that are responsible for that integration of those generic solutions? If it is the same group of people, awesome, you can put it in the same bounded context. And finally, we have that models thing. The question is whether you have conflicting models across those generic solutions. If that's the case, then I would argue that you better decompose it into multiple bounded contexts. If not, you can still have them in single bounded context. So again, it's all about two things. First one is models, and the second one is people. Well, models are people. It's all about people. So that's the longer answer. It depends on the models and your organizational structure.
That makes a lot of sense. And so we're mentioning a lot of models there. And I'm just wondering, like, what role does modeling, especially like collaborative techniques like event storming and domain storytelling play in sharing that understanding and then in system design?
I would say it plays a very important role, because the goal of this methodology was to provide a way for us introverts who are not interested in communicating with people to teach us how to communicate with them and to extract that information, how to get that knowledge about the business domain. And then those newer, let's say, collaborative modeling techniques came along, like event storming and domain storytelling, that provide a more effective way of doing it. So in my opinion, event storming is the most efficient way to build shared understanding of the business domain. So it's super important. Now, as much as I love event storming, that model has some blind spots that are addressed by domain storytelling. Now, should you use all of them? Well, at least use some of them. Start using event storming and then, you know, add more tools to your tool belt in the future if you need that. But yeah, that's super important.
That's really interesting. And maybe for the audience, it'd be great maybe to go into a little bit about at a high level, like what event storming is, and then also domain storytelling, because that's something much newer that is definitely from my side of things, and how they differ. And as you say, the blind spots maybe that a domain storytelling is able to kind of shine a light on that event storming hides.
Yeah. So event storming it's a workshop. It was something that was designed to be in-person workshop where you have a group of people gathered in the same room, and their goal is to build that shared understanding of a business domain or a part of that business domain. And they're doing it in the form of brainstorming what happens in that business domain in form of events, orange sticky notes that describe things that happened in that business domain. Usually such a session starts with awkward silence. And then someone puts the first sticker on the board.
The brave one. Or probably the opponent, the one who's actually running it.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe that person writes their advertising campaign was published. And suddenly people are saying, okay, before it was published, it was activated, et cetera, and suddenly we have that brainstorming activity of things that are happening in that business domain. First stage is we just write everything that comes to the mind on sticky notes, putting it on the wall. Once we have that a slower speed of adding new sticky notes to the board, then we'll say, okay, let's pause, let's reflect, let's look what we have here. Maybe we have duplicates, let's remove them. Maybe you identify something that is missing, let's add that, and let's organize them into a timeline. What is the timeline? How things are happening in the business domain? Now, that's the basic event storming session. It's about domain events. Now, there are different flavors to it. As its inventor, Alberto Brandolini, says, well, it's like a pizza. You have the basic recipe, but the toppings, you choose, do whatever you want. Same here. There are different ways to do event storming. Some are more finer grained than others. For example, you can do a whole process mapping when you will model also the commands that are issued in the system that result in those domain events, then you will put the roles of the people that are doing that. You will map the systems that are integrated in that system and the processes, the rules that trigger different actions in the system. That's a much more detailed approach, and for that you will need a more limited set of business functionalities to explore, because it will take a lot of time.
And with this, I think you said something important there with the event storming, is that it was in person. And I think that's obviously something with COVID and things like that. A lot of it's become remote. And I'm just wondering, how do you find, like, what makes like a modeling session effective? And also, has the remote-esque feel to this actually, you know, hampered its effectiveness?
Yeah, so initially it was introduced as in-person activity, a really fun activity. And its limitation was, you know, the physical one. How many people can you put in the same room until it's going to be overcrowded and not everyone will have a chance to collaborate? That's usually about 10 people. And then COVID happened. And suddenly, for almost a year, we couldn't do it in person. And we had no choice but to start doing it online with tools like Miro, or there is a new tool by Apple, I don't remember its name, something like Miro by Apple. And suddenly, yeah, turned out that it works online as well. You can do event storming remotely, but that limitation of how many people are going to invite to the session, well, it got compressed. Because if in person you can have 10 people collaborating, when you're doing it remotely, well, it's so much easier to slack off and like, I will just watch, I will let others do it, and then you're left with only one person doing all the work. So that's something that you want to avoid at all costs when doing event storming, because the goal is to share the knowledge, to build that shared understanding. For that, you need everyone to collaborate. Therefore, my rule for doing it remotely is 4 to 6 people online and a policeman. A policeman that makes sure the people are there. If suddenly someone is not there, let's send a ping, and
Just give him a poke kind of thing and be like, hey, that makes sense.
Yeah, let's have a break.
And I think a little segue there, but it's going on the modeling front. And again, it's from your blog. And so it was an F1 modeling analogy that you gave. It touched my heart as well. I'm a massive F1 fan too. So I really did like your analogy about Jack Doohan's F1 crash. We would put aside what Alpine's doing at the moment, in F1. But it also mentioned that how a simulator model failed. So I'm just wondering, like, what does that teach us about like flawed software models, this analogy?
Yeah. So when we are, again, going back to the idea of ubiquitous language, what is the language? It's our understanding, our mental model of how the business domain works. If we make a mistake, we have like a flawed understanding of how that business is supposed to work, well, that flawed understanding is going to be translated into the code that will make a flawed decision in the system you're working on. In that example of a Formula One crash, we had that simulator that was supposed to model a very complex thing. Like, it's insanely hard task, you know, to do, to model how the race car behaves on the track. But I can give you, you know, not such a sexy example like Formula One, but from my life, when we had a financial system that ended up losing $200,000 because of a bad decision it made. And that bad decision was because it was, you know, modeled incorrectly.
Yeah, that one's definitely not nice at all, I'm sure. Jeez. Yeah. But as you say, yeah, this is interesting with the modeling. And as you say, like, it's garbage in, garbage out. I mean, I'm doing a lot of stuff with the ML stuff at the moment. It's the same thing. If you put something wrong in, then you're going to get the wrong thing out. And a very similar thing with our models that we have. If we're told the wrong thing, then we are going to build the wrong thing. And even in discovery and things like that, if we still can't find what is correct, we're not going to be able to actually correctly, you know, produce something. And so... I've kind of touched upon it a little bit there. We've kind of talked about the modeling side of things now. And it's now talking about how we decide on transaction scripts, active record, or this full-blown domain models at the implementation level. So I'm just wondering, like, what are the decisions around that to actually decide on how you implement the code? This is now the fun part for developers.
Yeah. So first of all, let's get back to the notion of misconceptions about domain-driven design. The original DDD book provided one way of implementing business logic, which is what Martin Fowler calls the domain model pattern. It uses more fine-grained patterns to provide a way of doing it, aggregates value objects, repositories, etc. But overall, it described one way to implement business logic. However, what people missed is that way of implementing business logic is supposed to be used when you're implementing something complex, core subdomains, that is. Now, it led to people thinking that aggregates, this is what domain-driven design is about. Or, you know, even worse, entities. Like I myself, Eric Evans's Blue Book, it's a bit hard to read, at least for me. So I read the first four or five chapters and, okay, entities, properties, I get it.
Oh, it's the cool stuff as well. Exactly. Yeah. Aggregates, value objects, entities. This is great. Let's get coding.
Yeah, exactly. And then you end up with lots and lots of accidental complexities. So that's why in my book, I wanted to include other ways of implementing business logic. Two of them for cases when the business logic is not complex. For cases when you're implementing a supporting subdomain or integrating a generic subdomain. So you have transaction script, you have an active record. For core subdomains, I explained what a domain model is. It's building blocks, aggregates, value objects, etc. And I also added the newer pattern that was introduced to domain-driven design by the community after the initial book was published, and that's the event-sourced domain model. Now, I'm using that awkward phrasing, event-sourced domain model, four words, instead of just saying event sourcing, because, well, you can do event sourcing without a domain model. But my experience, for me, it didn't work. So that's why I'm only teaching what worked for me.
And I think it's also, sorry, so you also in your book, and I think you quite rightfully say, instead of core domain, it's core subdomain. it's adding those extra words that it, or an extra, you know, so it really helps with the ambiguity of it.
Yeah, that's another hill I'm ready to die on. And actually, it's not something that I introduced. If you look at the blue book, you will see that a few chapters use that term subdomain as well.
Yeah, it wasn't consistent though.
Yeah.
But then I guess with this, so, you know, the architecture, well, something interesting as well in your book is you then talk about the testing. And I think this is so important. It's like, how do you find then the architecture and testing evolve alongside your domain understanding and what architectural patterns that you decide to use for that particular bounded context?
Yeah. So first of all, you have that knowledge about the subdomain that the business logic you're implementing belongs to. You know its type. If it's supporting, do something simple. If it's core, well, make sure you're prepared for those changes that are going to happen in the future. So use your heavy design artillery here. Use more advanced tools. So here we'll need a domain model or an event sourced domain model. Now, whatever pattern you choose, it also affects how you should design the inner workings between the components within the bounded context. What I mean is the architectural pattern. Here we have layered architecture, we have ports and adapters, also known as hexagonal architecture or onion architecture, whatever you want to call it, architecture. And we have CQRS. CQRS can be beneficial in some cases. If you are implementing a domain model, you probably need ports and adapters. If you're using transaction script or active record, you can use layered architecture. Again, the simplest tool that will just work for your specific case. And then we're getting to the interesting part about testing, because, well, people love to fight about tests. Like, what tests are the best ones? I am writing integration tests and I can swear by them. And then you can hear someone, well, end-to-end test is the thing. And I've heard so many such arguments and I took part in some of them and tried to understand why certain type of tests work for one group of people, but not for others, and vice versa. And what I came to realize that, hey, end-to-end tests work best for simpler cases of business logic because the complexity of that business logic is lower there. So you can just cover it in a couple of end-to-end tests. In the language of domain-driven design, that relates to supporting subdomains. Now, if you are implementing that supporting subdomain, let's say using the active record pattern, then some of the business logic is going to be spread across different parts of that solution. So integration tests make more sense. Finally, if you have aggregates, that is, you're implementing a domain model or event source domain model, you have that perfect boundary of a unit for unit tests. So that's why I included the testing strategy in that chapter as well.
Yeah, I think it's really valuable, really valuable. And so from here then, thinking about bounded contexts, you know, we've got these subdomains, the bounded contexts, and then we have kind of not really touched upon yet interaction between bounded contexts. So, you know, we've got these little units of behavior, how we want to interact and how we don't pollute the different models and protect each other. We've kind of touched upon a bit about anti-corruption layer, but there are a couple more different integration patterns. So it'd be really good to talk about what the patterns are and how they help maintain the integrity of the boundaries.
Yeah, so domain-driven design, it describes a number of bounded context integration patterns. The thing is, they have nothing to do with bounded context. They are about people and how those people who are involved in those integrations are willing to communicate with each other, because some are more inclined towards cooperation than others. Let's say you have two bounded contexts, and the first case is two bounded contexts are owned by the same team. Well, probably the collaboration is going to work between that team and itself. So you can use some ad hoc integration or, in DDD terms, a partnership. If, on the other hand, two teams are involved, and if they are co-located, if they have well-established collaboration, that is, they will succeed or fail together, so they are interested in achieving some overarching goal together, in that case, again, ad hoc collaboration will work. If, on the other hand, the company is growing and suddenly you have teams that are maybe distributed geographically in different development centers or different countries, or maybe even in the same building, but they have different goals to achieve, then suddenly that collaboration is not going to work so well. So domain-driven design says, hey, in those cases, we have three patterns called customer-supplier relationships. First, whoever dictates the bounded context, we'll call them the upstream, and who consumes that language, that integration model, we'll call them downstream. That downstream may say, okay, I will just conform to whatever integration model is exposed by the upstream. That's the conformist pattern. Or maybe they will say, no, that will pollute my code base, so let's transform it into a more well-designed model. That's the anti-corruption layer that we mentioned earlier. Or maybe the upstream is going to be more a well-behaved one and will want to protect the downstream bounded context from the changes that are done to its implementation model. Then they will implement what's called open host service and implement a published language. Published language is model of a model. It's like an integration model that encapsulates the implementation model within that bounded context. And finally, we can encounter a situation, I definitely encountered it a couple of times, when you have two teams and it's simpler to duplicate the solution than to make them integrate. That's the separate ways spectrum.
Now, agree to disagree.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I mean, you're talking a lot there about teams, and I think a very important part around that is it's all about people. Again, this is not a technical thing, this is a people thing. And in teams then, I wonder, how do you find DDD connects with like the organizational structure and team boundaries? That's something that's very interesting. Things like thinking about team topologies. And like, how does DDD and team topologies reinforce each other?
Well, team topologies, if I remember correctly, it came out of the DDD community, so it was inspired by DDD a lot. Now, DDD can really highlight the inefficiencies in organizational design, because we want to align ownership boundaries with bounded contexts. Now, if suddenly you cannot do it, maybe because you have two teams that have to work on the same code base, well, we have a problem. Either in the code base, in the boundaries of the code base, or in the boundaries of the teams. Maybe they have to be merged. Or maybe you are trying to enforce that ownership boundary and that results in conflicts, in blaming each other constantly. Well, again, that's an organizational issue that needs to be addressed. And yeah, that separate ways thing, it highlights something important about, you know, how you're going to assign the business functionalities that are going to be implemented by teams. Because separate ways, it can work for generic subdomains, for sure. You can just duplicate the generic implementation, that's fine. In some cases, it can work for supporting functionalities, for supporting subdomains. Sometimes you can implement them in two places if they are managing different sets of data. It will work. Core subdomains, never.
You're just competing with yourself here.
Yeah. So that's another important piece of organizational design that is highlighted by domain-driven design. If you have that situation, you have a problem.
And I guess from here in your experience then, like, have you seen organizations or restructures based on this modeling? Like how things have changed?
Yes. Slowly but surely, yes. Yes. I've seen organizations that were restructured according to the structure of their bounded context. And I've seen cases where in which a company, for example, was growing and suddenly that collaboration that was working before stopped working because now we have teams in different countries and we are hiring new team members. They're not familiar with each other. They don't have that bond of working together previously. And suddenly a different integration pattern was needed. So yeah, I saw it happening, but in both ways. Not only DDD affecting the structure, but the structure of the organization affecting the design of the system.
And we have also touched on it a little bit with startups, but I do wonder, like, this is something, like, can domain-driven design work in, like, a highly experimental, fast-changing environment like a startup? And I know actually, in a case in point, and in your book, you mention it, you are a testament to this, that it can work.
Yeah, of course, it all depends on the startup, right? But yeah, it definitely can work. But at a startup, you need to be, you know, responsible for the rules you're breaking. In a startup, sometimes you will have to break some of the rules that are described by DDD. Now, that's fine to break a rule as long as you understand what that rule protects you from. If that danger is not relevant in your case, that's fine. Break the rule. If suddenly it is relevant for you in the future, you have to be responsible to go back and redesign whatever you did there when you broke that rule. Now, that rule breaking happens a lot in startup companies. And yeah, it can work, but at a startup company, I would suggest you to keep that relationship with the business people as healthy as possible to really understand the principles of DDD. Like, not only what you should do, but why you should do that. That will give you a much better edge. And that's especially important in startup companies.
Yeah, because I mean, I want to follow up to that, and I think this may be a little bit disillusioned, but like, what parts of DDD could you skip or simplify early on? Or what would you get biggest bang for your buck? I think you kind of alluded to it there, like for, say, in the startup environment.
Yeah, so first of all, technical patterns. In my opinion, strategic DDD is the important part of that methodology. Strategic patterns, you know, the blue book was written with a description of how to implement a domain model. And then we saw that we have event sourcing. In some cases, it's a more efficient way to implement the business logic. Now, that efficiency can also mean that, well, right now, I am not that confident about my understanding of aggregate boundaries. I don't have all that knowledge about that business domain. How can I make the decision about aggregate boundaries?
You know the least at the start, and then you're making up these things. Exactly. Coming into a domain, you know, trying to apply domain-driven design to an already, you know, sold thing or an actual large business is a lot easier because it's already there in front of you. How can you discover something that isn't been discovered yet?
Yeah, exactly. That's why I would skip technical patterns. Ubiquitous language, that's the most important part of domain-driven design, especially in startups. Bound context, that's just an extension of ubiquitous language. Subdomains, well, you have to understand what the problem your startup is solving, for whom, and what is the solution. So,
and where you apply your time and effort. This is exactly, I mean, this is what we implicitly do in this kind of thing. You're going to be like, you know, I'm not going to solve and think everything. Like, as you say, with a supporting subdomain, it's around like, well, I think you mentioned like, you know, inventory management or something. If that's not the core differentiator with our business, there's no point in us spending time on it. It's a waste of time. And this is what is great. And I think it kind of unfortunately gets, you know, people get scared of it around DDD, but this is what's great about subdomains. And in naming these things, you can concretely understand where you need to place your effort, the good people, the time, the effort itself.
Yeah, exactly.
Going on from there, so we've talked about startups there, but like for teams, say, that are new to DDD, but they're in a business already that's flourishing, hopefully, like what's a good place to start? And like, how can they adopt it without getting overwhelmed? I think that's one of the things that one of the hardest is like, you hear a lot of these terms, we're talking about strategic, we're talking about tactical, we're talking about subdomains, bounded context and everything. Like, yeah, how can they adopt it without being overwhelmed?
Yeah, so I would address that situation with, don't try to apply all of domain-driven design at once. It's not going to work and your colleagues will want to kill you or something.
Or leave. They're just, yeah. They're you'll be leaving or they'll be leaving.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. Instead, implement the practices of domain-driven design gradually. Start by aligning your understanding, your mental model of the business with the business itself. So analyze the subdomains. Ask about the company, ask about your competitors. What's the difference between the company and other players in the market? Understand the strategy. That's something that you need to know. And yeah, unfortunately, it's something that, you know, when a new hire joins a company, that's usually not a part of the onboarding process, but it's super important.
Yeah, we go with the tech stack and all this and like maybe a brief overview, but not that deep.
Yeah, exactly. And then go over the tech stack. Look at the let's say, coarse-grained components of the system. Those are kind of bounded context, even if they're not following the rules of bounded context, but just try to understand, you know, the high-level architecture of the system and the teams that are involved in the work on those components. Maybe if that's a huge enterprise company, well, focus on, you know, on those building blocks that are related to your area of work and how it is integrated with other teams in the same company. And then after that, I would say focus on what hurts. Try to identify what hurts the most and what parts of domain-driven design can help. Now, let's say that you identify that we have a certain part in the system that is a part of core subdomain. It changes frequently. Each new feature feels like an adventure that you are not really interested in doing. Something that starts one way and ends up in, as we said, in the Kinevan part, in a series of safe experiments. Well, see what you can do about that design. Now, let's say that you decided I have to introduce aggregates here because I will have those consistency boundaries that will make the evolution of the code easier and will make it easier to enforce those rules. Well, go and tell your colleagues that we need aggregates here because they don't know what aggregates are. Again, start by getting an agreement on the problem you have in the system. And then maybe even ask your colleagues, how can we address that problem? And usually, if that solution is viable, it will be aligned with one of the patterns from the DDD. And yeah, and that's the gateway drug to domain-driven design.
No, I think there's something you mentioned in another talk was it's around like, don't class yourself as like the DDD evangelist. You know, it's not something you're trying to push on people. And it's sometimes you say like, people are going to naturally learn this themselves. It's almost like they want them to relearn DDD, which may seem counterintuitive and counterproductive, but it's the best way of selling it to people and is to see what, you know, how can we solve the problem using these techniques? Doesn't matter what the name is, doesn't matter where they're coming from. It's just that they are actually helping solve a problem.
Yeah. I remember people critiquing domain-driven design saying, hey, this methodology is nothing new. It's just common sense wrapped in a set of new terms. Well, if it's common sense, why it's not common at all? Like, yeah. Why are not doing it? Now, still, you can introduce it as common sense. If you want to focus on the terms, on the names of the patterns from DDD, but rather the problems they are solving and how they are solving them, and suddenly you are getting back to that common sense realm. So it's a shortcut. It makes it much easier to introduce that methodology in a company.
And then from there, like you say, people can apply it to a business that they know, maybe another business that they can kind of make up. And I do just wonder, like, how do you find people like to help strengthen their like strategic design muscle, something where they can actually hone and try out exploring these types of domains?
Well, that's a great question, because that's another major hurdle when, you know, someone wants to learn domain-driven design. How can we get that experience? Well, for strategic aspect of DDD, you can analyze your past workplaces. Try to analyze those companies. Try to map their subdomains. Usually you will have some knowledge about them. Think about, again, competitors, compare them. That can be a great exercise. A bounded context, again, try to use your experience from other workplaces or maybe even from where you're working at the moment. Map those coarse-grained architectural components. Look who is working on them. Maybe there are multiple teams in charge of the same component, so maybe you can spot some conflicts, some friction between them. Now you know why. Or maybe the design did work well, and you will find the alignment with the principles of DDD. So that's strategic part. Now, technical DDD is harder. It's harder because we have domain model and event source domain model, two patterns that are really hard, you know, to get hands-on experience in implementing them. In some cases, I'm always saying that these patterns are for complex problems, for core subdomains, but supporting subdomains, because of the low uncertainty, because of the low volatility.
Yeah, the risk factor in them for the business and things like that.
Yeah, the risk factor is low, so use them as your training wheels. implement aggregates there. Nobody needs them there. It's architectural gold plating, but the moment you decide consciously that this is my training area, then it's not architectural gold plating. That's you gaining experience.
Yeah, and you're adding value, absolutely. Something else that I've started doing, and this kind of goes onto the AI train here. So I've actually over the last couple of weeks been using like LLMs, such as like ChatGPT, to like aid in building like contrived fictitious businesses of which I can kind of interact with and like to help discover like useful subdomains and bounded contexts. There's a couple of options in like the OpenAI ChatGPT stuff around studying. And I found it's worked really quite well. Like it's quite fun. Like you can interact with these people. You can pretend to have mock kind of conversations with different personalities, different actors in that. And yeah, I've been quite surprised. I don't know if you've had been playing around with things like that, but it's quite a nice testing tool. And it's obviously a cheap way of being able to explore these kind of, you know, in this particular strategic way. And then you can distill this down and you can obviously then build the tactical chops as well, because you can now take this, you know, fictitious business and then kind of push on and explore it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great idea. I didn't do that, but...
It's quite fun. I'll be honest. I would say give it a go because it is actually quite fun. You can start to play around, pretend people to be domain experts and things like this. And you can really start to... It's strange, but it kind of helps you hone those detective and analysis skills. Yeah, I've enjoyed doing it.
I will try that. Thank you.
Absolutely. And I think that kind of goes into then like the AI tooling. And I know something you mentioned before around, you know, possibly a second edition, which gets my hopes up, and more writing from you would be great. But like with the rise of like this AI tooling, like what role do you see it playing in supporting like not only the tactical coding, because obviously that's one thing, but also like the strategic modeling and the domain discovery and using it to help, you know, that like explore these businesses?
Yeah, the funny thing about domain-driven design is when this methodology was introduced 20 years ago, it started slowly, you know. It was like niche methodology, a niche set of consultants that read the blue book, the whole blue book, and then applied it. Then microservices happened 10 years ago, 12 years ago.
And then microservices, a bounded context happened, and then everyone.
Yeah, and then suddenly everyone wants bounded context. Well, it took us some time to realize what bounded contexts are, etc. But yeah, that gave an insane boost to that methodology. Now, what happens right now with LLMs is that suddenly in that language part, everyone really understand, hey, this is important. Our mental models of the business domains are important, because if we have clear understanding of the business domain, we can use it to interact with an LLM. And if we are not clear, then the outcome, the result, the code it's going to write is going to be
garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah, exactly. So in my opinion, LLMs are supposed to give an insane boost to the notion of a ubiquitous language.
It is really exciting. And I think something you've touched upon, like maybe on your blog and stuff, is like, what risk do you see in using like AI to generate models of core subdomain logic? I'm just wondering kind of like, yeah, using AI for specifically core subdomains.
Yeah, so look, I'm no expert in AI or LLMs. I'm using them and I can tell you about my experience. My experience is, let's say that I'm working on a core subdomain and I feel like lazy and I'm asking you to implement it. Build this aggregate for me, for example. Then I describe the business logic. First of all, you cannot trust that language model to know what an aggregate is. It learned about aggregates from Stack Overflow, so come on. Lower your expectations and start by explaining what is an aggregate and what principles you want it to obey.
And show examples in if you've got context already of ways that you've, you know, it very much helps aid it in that direction.
Yeah, exactly. So first of all, make sure you're teaching the LLM what you wanted to produce. Second, from my experience, it produced, when you give it the freedom to build a solution, it will build a model that will work for the functionalities that you described. But it failed to account for those reasonable changes in the future. Those reasonable changes in the future would result in a complete rewrite of that garbage. So again, in my experience, I had to help it with modeling. I had to build a model myself. However, once I had that model, once I had that initial structure, filling those Lego blocks of different methods, different functionalities, it helped me so much.
Yeah, it's incredibly powerful. But I think it's interesting you mentioned there how, and I think this is again communication, and because you said, oh, the likely changes. So it produced this code and there were some likely changes that obviously it didn't cater for. And that's because it didn't know. It didn't know. It didn't ask. There was no context around USET. And this is, again, more communication. The fact is an LLM is a large language model. It's even more communicating and even more explicit communication as opposed to the implicit that we're so used to and hidden behind. What's in that prompt window or in that prompt and what it's obviously trained on in its training phase, pre-training phase and stuff like that, and then been trained on afterwards post. All it knows is this. And that's where we're going to have to be even more communicative, even just to our computers now. And so communication all the way around is all the way.
Yeah, that can push us towards some philosophical debates about LLMs. And people who are against that idea of using LLMs for writing code, they're saying that LLMs are trained on the past, on the information that comes from the past. Now, when modeling, we need to account for the future, which is not that clear as the past. So. But yeah, I have not.
But then doesn't the past possibly dictate the future in some way? There's this kind of thing as well. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting, but I don't have an opinion here because, yeah, if you were to ask me 5 years ago about what AI will be able to do in 5 years, no way. Like, I would say maybe better text completion on phone.
100%. And I think this is the thing we've realized, I mean, as a whole industry, is just how this idea from 2017 with Transformers, and then obviously with OpenAI bringing these things out with GPT-2, and then going to 3, and how bigger they can get with these deep learning models and stuff. It's nuts. And we're still trying to get bigger, better, and we're all learning. I think there's no expert. I don't think there is an expert in using an LLM. I think this is the thing. It changes. And obviously prompt engineering and all these kind of things. It's an incredibly interesting time, and it's trying to utilize it for these things, such as, you know, say we're using it for LLM for learning these DDD concepts and understanding and trying to build up these fictitious stories. Because for me personally, like trying to play around, it's hard to make up these stories, but guess what? LLMs are very good at making up things and saying good and bad. So in this case, if I want you to subtly put subdomains and bounded contexts and all these things in, so it's quite interesting. Anyway, I realize I've taken up a lot of your time. And so I just want to say thank you so much for coming on. I really do appreciate it. I do like to leave on one question. And it's a really important one to me. It's just, I wonder, like, how do you individually learn best? I find it such an invaluable skill for us to all individually like learn how we learn, whether it be through podcasts, audio, trying things out and stuff like that. So I'm just wondering, like, what have you discovered about the ways you learn most effectively over the years?
No taking. You know, let's say if I'm reading a book, if by the end of the chapter I can summarize concisely what the chapter is about, then I feel like I really learned something about it.
And that doesn't mean just running it through an LLM and getting it to summarize. We should say this now.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So for me, you know, effective learning requires doing something about that knowledge, not just reading it and letting the mind forget about it.
No, I think that's so true. And it's been able to, I'd say, process it in your mind and then be able to speak it in your own words. That digestion and that processing phase is so important. Thank you again so much. I just want to leave on, and like, what is the best place for people to keep up to date with you and all the goings on of what you're up to?
Yeah, so you can find me on LinkedIn and you can find me on Twitter or whatever it is called nowadays. And the second one, Blue Sky. I have an account there. I'm not really active, but you can find me there as well. I try to cross-post all the stuff I write across the three social networks now. And yeah, I would say LinkedIn is the best place.
Awesome. Well, again, thank you so much, Vlad. I really do appreciate it. And then an audience, until next time, goodbye.
Thank you so much, Ed. Thank you so much for having me.